Money matters. Keeping Iowa's fiscal house in order requires careful management and precise accountability. A conversation with key executives, State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald and State Auditor David Vaught on this edition of Iowa Press.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation.
Iowa banks know you want honest advice about how to best reach your financial goals. Whether it's financing and education, buying a new home, growing a business, or funding retirement, Iowa banks, Iowa values. MyIowaBank.com.
For decades, Iowa Press has brought you politicians and newsmakers from across Iowa and beyond. Celebrating 41 years of broadcast excellence on statewide Iowa Public Television, this is the Friday, July 13 edition of Iowa Press. Here is Dean Borg.
Theoretically, public money is everyone's money. Ultimately, public funds belong to Iowa citizens, taxpayers. But paraphrasing an old adage, when everyone's in charge, no one's in charge. Iowans elected Democrat Michael Fitzgerald, state treasurer, 30 years ago. In that job, he currently invests more than $3 billion in state operating funds, and he's custodian of Iowa's three state pension funds. Republican David Vaught is the taxpayer's watchdog. He was elected state auditor 9 years ago, overseeing not only state agencies and the programs they administer, but also counties, cities, and towns, and auditing them, and school districts, too. Across the state, gentlemen, welcome back to Iowa Press.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Dean.
And across the Iowa Press table, WHO TV reporter David Price and Radio Iowa News Director Kay Henderson.
Mr. Vaught, this past week you issued an analysis of the state budget. There's a record surplus, but you identified a structural deficit. How is that possible?
Well, what you have to understand is Legislative Services Agency actually calculates and presents the budget in accordance with Iowa law. Regretfully, Iowa law doesn't always follow good budgeting principles. So I take it a step further than what Legislative Services Agency does and actually contrast that against good budgeting principles. And under Iowa law, you can actually take a surplus from 1 year, carry it forward, and spend it in the following year. However, those are one-time monies. Just because you had a surplus this year doesn't mean you'll have a surplus next year. And under good budgeting principles, you're not supposed to use those one-time monies for ongoing expenses. So once you factor in the $300 million or so of surplus from last year that's carried forward to this year, you can reduce that surplus that LSA presents under Iowa law down to about $65 million spending gap instead. And then there's another over $70 million worth of one-time monies that are also built into the fiscal year 13 budget. So when you add those in and a couple of other minor modifications, you get to about $161 million spending gap that I presented under good budgeting principles.
Mr. Fitzgerald, should Iowans be concerned about this?
Well, you know, I give David credit for doing a fine job being the state auditor and such. But let's look at the big picture here in Iowa. And Iowa, if you ask me, how is Iowa doing? I'd say, you know, it's the same thing as asking your kids when they come home from school. How are you doing in school? Well, what does the teacher say? And in Iowa, the three major rating agencies in Wall Street, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, Fitch, all give Iowa AAA ratings. We're one of, there's only seven other states that can say that. We have that because we have a balanced budget. And we have reserves every year. As a matter of fact, we have a balanced budget with $1 billion of reserves on hand. And we had that last year. And every year in the past 5 years since we've had AAA, we've had a balanced budget and we've had reserves. That's outstanding, and especially through the financial crisis that we've just been through. That speaks well for Iowa. And also Iowa has a real disciplined way of putting its budget together, managing its finance. It's proved it. And it's you know, we have a nonpartisan revenue estimating committee. They outline, this is how much the legislature can spend. They're only supposed to spend 99%.
Are you saying, Mr. Fitzgerald, that Iowa is better off than the state auditor says we are?
Well, I don't mean to speak for David, and I don't think David's really saying the state's that bad. I think he's quibbling with accounting practices and such. I'm saying if you look at the big picture of Iowa, our finances are terrific. We're solid shape, especially considering what this country has went through.
Terrific and solid. Are those words you would use to describe the state's finances, Mr. Vogt?
No, we've made huge improvements in the last 2 years, I will tell you that. But back in fiscal year 11, we actually had a $764 million spending gap. And just to make sure people understand, the reason we look at the budget and the way that I look at it under good budgeting principles is to say, can we sustain the level of service we're providing today into the future? And that's where we really have to be concerned. I agree that Iowa has a AAA credit rating, but have you ever looked at the rating agency's credit reports? If you haven't, you should do that someday, because I seriously question the depth that the rating agencies go to. I will tell you that I'm surprised that I've served as Iowa State Auditor for going on 10 years now, and I've never been contacted by a credit rating agency about Iowa's fiscal practices. And since the recession hit and the financial crisis, credit rating agencies have been highly criticized, and justifiably so, for their failure to do the right type of ratings. And as we look forward, it's very important those credit rating agencies give a good picture to the public. And regretfully, credit rating agencies have kind of let ratings roll on, but then once the crisis hits, they tell us they're going to downgrade. Well, it doesn't help to tell us after it's already happened. So it's so important that credit rating agencies do their job, because the public is depending heavily on those.
This past week, you talked about progress. So you pointed to 2 years ago in the fiscal budget, we were spending essentially $1.14 for every dollar we had coming in, and this year's budget is more like $1.03 per that dollar. Having said that, though, if you start looking at the figures, we all remember how Terry Branstad campaigned, saying that we needed reliability, predictability, none of these one-time monies. In his proposal, as you point out, in this current fiscal budget, he himself, according to your numbers, proposed spending more money than we would have coming in. So is he not following what he ran on?
I think definitely what you have to look at is the progress that we're making. It took us several years to dig the hole that we're in, where we're spending more than we have available. So as I've always said from the start, it's going to take us a few years to climb back out of that hole. And so what I'm looking for is progress. And what the good news is, in fiscal year 12 and the fiscal year 13 budget, I'm very encouraged, because we're making improvements and continuing that improvement progress down the road.
But going into this, almost everybody was pointing that we should have some surpluses as the economy started going back, and especially the ag economy. Why would he not put a budget together, though, that, taking that into account, spent less than what we're supposed to?
Well, because the real problem gets to be is when you're spending, like in fiscal year 11, $764 million, then what the ongoing revenue stream will supply, if you're going to correct that all in 1 year, you're going to have to drastically cut services to do that. And so the reasonable approach is to say, let's head down the road in the right direction, make the types of changes that we can, and implement that over a period of time. If it was a smaller amount, it would be much easier to accomplish. But when you dig that big of a hole, it takes a while to climb back out.
Mr. Fitzgerald, just maybe this is semantics, but do you even agree that there is this structural deficit, or are these just accounting terms?
Well, I think it's more accounting terms. But you know, what is the one-time funds? Well, they're the government funds. We went through the crisis, and the federal government appropriated over $700 million for the state of Iowa. Our legislature spent it over 2 years to keep our state going through those tough times. But keep in mind, the legislature took, you know, they come in. How much money do we have to spend? That's why the legislature meets every year. How much money do we have to spend? They consider the one-time funds, federal government payments. Stimulus funds. Put together the budget, and that's what Iowa spent. Now, the rating agencies, who I have a lot of faith in, and they do contact our office and management, and they stay up on our financial records, have said we had discipline in the state of Iowa. And you remember going through the tough times. Iowa did cut back. We had 10% across-the-board cuts. Those were hard to take. But Iowa was a state that was proactive and met those challenges right on. We weren't poo-pooing it like a lot of states, like Illinois, saying, oh, things will get better. We dealt with it at the time, balanced the budget. We always balance the budget, and we have to. Now, we may use some one-time funds, but we have a balanced budget, and we've always had reserves. And then when the rating agencies see that, oh, they say, oh, my gosh, no other state's in that good a shape. That's why one of the main reasons we're AAA.
Okay.
Speaking of bad times, during the bad economy of the 1980s and into the 1990s, it seemed as if former state auditor Richard Johnson, a Republican, and Michael Fitzgerald, a Democrat, were singing from the same hymn book in terms of the state's finances. Why isn't that the case these days?
Well, I don't know if we're that far apart. And one of the things we didn't have back in the old days, when the legislature had come to town or the governor would present a budget, he'd just pick a number out of the air. I think we're going to have $5 billion in revenue this year. Well, our new system says we're going to have a nonpartisan, three-person revenue estimating committee put together academically what's reasonable revenue projections. And they've had a good track record within 2% over the last 10 years. You know, nobody can predict 100% accurately, but they've been very, very accurate. And then the legislature says they can only spend 99% of those figures. And they've tried to follow it. There's been a couple years where, notwithstanding, they spent the money. But in most years, they have followed that. And then, the big part, we've adopted what we call gap accounting, generally accepted accounting principles. The important part there is somebody else is setting the rules. Now, maybe they're not perfect rules, and David may have some good criticisms. But we follow outside rules. So we have a balanced budget under gap accounting, and we have reserves. That's why we're AAA, and that's why we're good states.
So, Mr. Vaught, do you think that the state's two fiscal officers, I'll just come up with that term for you, do you think you are collaborating on this, or are you painting two disparate pictures for the public?
No, I don't think so. I think what I'm trying to emphasize is what the federal government has failed to do, which is be able to sustain the level of services that we're providing. So when you take a look at it, it's like a family. And let's say one of the wage earners receives a bonus at the end of the year. So the family decides that they're going to buy a larger house and take on a larger mortgage. Well, they're going to use those one-time monies to help pay for that larger mortgage. Mm-hmm. The problem is the following year, when those one-time monies aren't there, they don't get another bonus, they can no longer afford that larger mortgage payment. And that's what I'm trying to do, is to say, how do we sustain our level of services that we have today?
Mr. Fitzgerald, a minute ago you used an analogy of a student coming home from school and the parent asking, how is school and how are you doing? And you asked, how is Iowa doing? How is Iowa doing right now prospectively with cornfields and soybean fields burning up right now? Does that cause you, and I'll ask you the same thing, Mr. Vaught, is that causing you some sleepless nights? Because the statistics that I have here from the Iowa Department of Agriculture says that overall in the year 2011, the corn crop in Iowa was worth $14.5 billion, and the soybeans were worth $5.5 billion. That adds up to a $20 billion initial impact of just the crop value itself, not to say the multiplier effect. That would have a huge hit, that is a crop loss this year, on Iowa's economy, would it not?
Oh, it's very much a concern. But this is the middle of July. Hopefully we'll get a little more rain. I can't predict whether how serious this drought will be.
No, I'm not asking you to predict the rainfall for the next couple of weeks. I'm saying, are we in trouble if we don't get rain, and big trouble?
Oh, yeah. Iowa's economy, the engine of Iowa's economy is agriculture. And we've done so well in the last few years. The last 3 years have been the best years ever for agriculture in Iowa. Land prices boomed. Commodity price, corn's now over $7 a bushel, soybeans up there. Farmers are making money, and that means John Deere's record profits and everybody that spins off of it. But, you know, Iowa's not quite in the bad shape we were in the 80s, Kay. We were just agriculture back then. We've expanded and diversified our economy here in Iowa. Our banking and insurance industry is growing, and it's strong. You know, the principals and the Wells Fargos and people like that. But also, we've added, thanks to, you know, our past administrations, you know, Governor Vilsack and Culver, and give Grassley a lot of credit. We've developed alternative energy in this state, paying off big time. Ethanol, biodiesel, and wind energy, that's adding to it. So, yes, the corn crop, if we have a severe drought, that's going to hurt us, but not like the 1980s.
You're saying we're diversified. Mr. Vaught, that causing you some sleepless nights prospectively?
Definitely. I mean, when we look at the ag economy, I think it had a huge impact on why Iowa's performed so well over the last couple of years.
And are we prospectively in trouble?
I think definitely we have to be very concerned, because what happens is, if that economy is impacted by the ag economy, which it will be, that means revenues will probably flatten out, or at least not grow as fast, or could even become worse and decline. And that's why it's so important that we don't use one-time monies in this fiscal year to pay for ongoing costs, because then those one-time monies go away along with the revenue growth, and you're in a double whammy as far as trying to provide services in a very difficult time.
In light of that, and we don't want to think about this, but let's say this is a drought, this is a bad year, and the ag economy really goes down. Do we have in our these so-called rainy day funds, do we have enough in surplus for this year, next year, or are we going to have to see some rather dramatic cuts to make up for that?
The good part is we do have our reserve funds pretty much full today. But keep in mind that only about 2.5% of the set aside 10% is actually related to economic emergencies. So we're only talking about $150 million that's set aside under Iowa law for economic emergency funds. So that's not a whole lot. The other 7.5% relates to our cash reserve funds. And we need those dollars there in order to be able to cash flow, make state aid payments on time before the tax revenues come in. So it doesn't give us lots of cushion.
Are you comfortable with that cushion, though? I mean, when you look at the dollars that we spend, $12 billion collectively with everything we spend, is that enough? Or should the funds be bigger?
It's going to make it still more difficult to balance the budget, and it won't mean that there won't be services cut, especially as costs go up, salaries and benefits and those types of things. It's going to be very difficult, and that's why we need to really focus on longer-term planning, thinking forward to say, yes, I can balance this year's budget, but how do I balance next year's budget if something impacts the revenue stream?
Mr. Fitzgerald, are you comfortable with what we have in the bank and the surplus?
Well, I think David's a little more alarmist. We have $600 million in the reserve funds, and the legislature can use all of that. They have access to it. They have higher vote totals. They have to go through maybe two-thirds of the spending, but there's $600 million there. There's also about another $600 million in surplus. And, you know, in Iowa, talking about have we been going through good times, the debate in the legislature is not, you know, most states, if they're in trouble, it's, well, what taxes do we raise? We're not talking about raising any taxes. And matter of fact, we've never raised income taxes as long as I've been in Treasurer of the State of Iowa. We're not talking about raising taxes. We're talking about cutting taxes. The legislature passed this year and the year before a 20% income tax cut. The governor's pushing a huge property tax for big businesses. So that's where the discussion is. So, yes, they want to take that money and give the argument is how do we spend that money? And so I say, you know, we have money and buttress us against economic problems.
Well, as Mr. Fitzgerald referenced, Republicans in the Iowa House have been talking about a big tax cut. Governor Branstad has been talking about tax cuts and property tax cuts. Mr. Vaught, you suggested this week using part of that surplus money to shore up the Iowa public employees' retirement system, the pension fund for tens of thousands of Iowans. I mean, that seems a little bit against the partisan tide here among your fellow Republicans.
Well, I think the key thing is Iowans want Iowa to be fiscally responsible, and that's what we expect from our elected officials. And I think it's so important that we think longer term and think about what some of the liabilities are. When you take a look at IFRS, it's important to understand that at the end of fiscal year 2000, we were 98% funded for that pension plan. And at the end of 2011, we're only 80% funded. So we've made a huge decline in funding, and
what
that's a key financial
funded,
statistic.
Funded means for future obligations
that's
of
right.
those who will be retiring.
Definitely. How many assets do you have set aside to cover the liability you've already incurred for those future payments? And when you drop that and you put it in terms of dollars, we've gone from about a $327 million unfunded liability at the end of fiscal year 2000 to a $5.7 billion shortfall at the end of fiscal year 2011. And that is almost 1 year of general fund revenues. That's a huge piece that we've got to take care of.
Are you giving IPER retirees, future ones, an ulcer by saying that?
I think one of the things that happens is in the short term, we're okay. But the sad part is even though we're 80% funded, which some people might argue is a good place to be, it also means we're 20% underfunded. And that's a real concern of mine and should be. And a lot of times people will say, well, we're not as bad as some other states. And I will agree. Illinois is one of the worst states, which is only about 50% funded. But I also say if your child comes home from school and tells you that they got a D on the math exam today, but Johnny next door got an F, should that make you feel better? No. We still have a concern that we've got to get that funded.
Well, Mr. Fitzgerald, you're a voting member of the board that governs the Iowa Public Employees Retirement System. Is it in trouble, and does there need to be, a state government bailout?
This is an area where David and I think are somewhat in agreement, but I have a little different perspective on it. IPERS is important to the state of Iowa, and the IPERS retirement system must be protected. You know, I think there's 330,000 Iowans depend on IPERS in one way or the other. And as David pointed out, it was doing just great up until 1998 or 2000. But in 1998, the governor made a change, and Democrats went along with it too. This is not a partisan issue. That the cap was taken off IPERS. It was set up back in the 50s. IPERS was. And the state employees and our employees put money in, and the state put some in too. It's not a freebie. They put in money and professionally invested, and it's run very, very well. It should pay for itself. Well, it was overfunded in the 90s, in the heyday of the 90s. So what they did for, it used to have a cutoff about $45,000 income. So a teacher would retire, set up for teachers. They could have maybe a $20,000 pension fund every year. Worked just great. Well, what happened? They took that cap off, and now you have some employees in state government that make as much as $250,000 can retire and get like $160,000 a year pension. That's broke the bank.
So you need, we need the cap.
I've advocated for putting a cap back in, maybe at $100,000, so the top pension would be like $60,000 a year. Mm-hmm. That's pretty darn good. That would help folks. It's not supposed to be the cure-all for everybody. But IPERS needs some fixing, but let me be clear. It needs to be protected. The people in Iowa that are relying on it, rest assured, IPERS is solid. And, compared to other states, we're right in the middle of the pack now. But we should have it up there about 100% funded.
Mr. Vowd, what about the cap? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think whenever you look at a defined benefit plan, which is what the IPERS plan is, you need to make sure that it's fiscally sound. And the key thing is there are actuaries that calculate what the contribution rates have to be. And that means if we're going to promise those benefits, we've got to be able to make those contributions. And that's where we failed. We've increased contribution rates recently. However, we were behind the ball on making sure that we were keeping up with those required contributions.
You've both followed what they've done in Wisconsin, where they've made far bigger changes to what state employees can expect to get. So is that where we're headed here? Do you feel that are we going to have to ask employees to contribute more and expect less at the end, whether it be caps or elsewhere?
I would say from my perspective, I think definitely we've already asked employees and the state and other governments to increase their contributions because it's what we need to actuarially make it work. But I would also tell you that there's a state of New York that is actually 100% funded in their pension liability, which somewhat surprised me knowing the state of New York. But also Wisconsin will be held out as being 100% funded. But what they don't tell you, and the state auditor from Wisconsin and I were talking, and they actually borrowed money to put it into their retirement plan in order to bring it up to date. So they're still way behind because they're paying off that debt in order to get there. So you have to look at a lot of the factors behind it, too.
Mr. Fitzgerald, should they expect less in the end?
Well, first, let me say this. I think, you know, the state and the employees do put money into IPERS. It needs to be protected. But we don't need to go to the taxpayers for any more money for IPERS and continue to have the employees put in their fair share. And they're doing that in Iowa now. I think we can make some adjustments. IPERS should be solid. But there is a trend, and I think it's disturbing in this country, about public employees are all of a sudden the bad guy. Governor Branstad doesn't miss a chance to blame public employees for one problem or another, puts them in a negative position. And that's just not the case. Public employees add to the very fiber of our society. They do important things, whether it's school teacher, fireman, policeman, or they drive the snowplow. And I know these people. They take their jobs very seriously, and they're committed to them, and we shouldn't be pitting one part of society against another. And that's kind of what's happened to public employees right now.
Governor Branstad a couple of weeks ago said that he would voluntarily give up part of his pay to pay 20% of his health care premium. Mm-hmm. Mr. Vowd, you said you would do the same. Mr. Fitzgerald, you said you would investigate. Have you made a decision?
Well, this was a surprise to the executive council. This was, you know, when somebody comes with a big, important decision like health insurance and say, sign right here, he didn't give us any information. And we have an insurance committee at the executive council that investigates these things. So it was a big surprise. He says we have a couple more weeks to make up our mind. That's why I viewed it as a political stunt. He's trying to castigate the public employees as mooching off the rest of us. And that's not the case. For 40 years, Okay, 40 years, the governor and labor has negotiated what salary, wages, and benefits should be and are. And it's worked well for the state of Iowa. When he pulls this little caper, he doesn't, you know, public employees are angry because this is a guy that lives in a free mansion from the state of Iowa. He gets a $130,000 salary. On top of that, he gets a $50,000 IPERS pension that none of the other people can have.
Mr. Vout, do you have a rebuttal?
I think definitely what the governor, from my perspective, is trying to do is to say that he feels it's appropriate for state workers to contribute. And the real key here is it's voluntary. No one's required to contribute. It's all voluntary. And what he'd like to do is be able to set the stage to say, I'm willing to step up, and are others of you willing to do the same thing? And I think one thing we have to keep in mind is when we look at compensation, we need to look at the total compensation package.
We said, both salaries and benefits. Your answer, Mr. Fitzgerald, are you going to contribute 20%?
Well, you know, now there's also been legal case. I'll answer your question. Legal case. There's been a legal case filed. Yes. Against this is whether it was illegal, tampering with the labor contracts. And
by AFSCME.
By AFSCME, it's a legitimate lawsuit. You know, the governor's lost a number of these, and we've paid out hundreds of thousands of dollars of legal fees for the governor when he pulls these things. And I will follow the process that we go through. And if it's legally set up that we public employees maybe should have to start paying some health care and insurance.
And
I will follow. I will follow what is legally established, and now that's in the court system, what comes back, I'll pay what we're required to pay.
Mr. Vout, do you think the employee contract was at all violated or tampered with by the governor's action?
You know, I'm not a legal expert at all. I stay in that accounting and auditing profession. However, I would tell you that when you look at it as being voluntary, I don't see what the real issue is because no one has to participate. It's just another voluntary contribution if you want to make it. And you don't have to participate if you don't.
Mr. Fitzgerald, do you feel then, are the Democrats going to hold back on this? I don't think I've heard any prominent Democrats come out here and say, no, I'm not paying this. I've heard some people say this is wrong, but no, I'm not going to pay. So is everybody going to wait back and see where this AFSCME suit goes?
Democrats are just like everybody else. Health insurance, that's a complicated issue. And it's a long process that we go through every year. David and I we're members of the insurance committee that we sort through the issues, what it costs, how do we develop programs. Some families, we offer different programs, you know, for families in the state. It's a complicated issue. So to just want you to jump in right now, that takes some time, and it puts public employees over a barrel. And remember, Governor Branstad is just about ready to go on Medicare. It's only about 1% of his pay.
Let me jump in. Both of you would be up for re-election in 2014. I'm not going to ask you if you're running. Would either of you voluntarily choose to return to the private sector, Mr. Vout?
You know, I think I've had experience in the private sector, and what I really enjoy about the public sector is I can bring some of those experiences to the table to help Iowa taxpayers.
Mr. Fitzgerald, quick.
I've worked in the public sector as well, and I enjoyed it, but I've also enjoyed my public service, and hope I can continue for a while.
We can't continue, though. We're out of time. Thanks for being with us. Next week on Iowa Press, insight into Iowa's labor unions. We'll be talking with Public Employee Union AFSCME's Danny Homan and Iowa Federation of Labor State President Ken Sager. Usual time, 7:30 Friday night, noon Sunday. I'm Dean Borg, and thanks for joining us today.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation.
Support comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Iowa banks work with you to offer products and advice for financing an education, buying a new home, growing a business, or funding retirement. Iowa banks, Iowa values. MyIowaBank.com.